going to get started. This is the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Today is Monday, March 12th. We don't yet have a quorum, but Representative Doty, if you want to come to the table, if we'll get started. All right. Once we do have a quorum, this bill will need to go to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Minnesota Heritage Finance. So with that, Representative Doty, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Hopefully you have before you the very brief language of House File 756. It is a repealer for legislation passed by this body last year. That was a bill that was that, as written, could only apply to the city of Little Falls, Minnesota. That legislation was intended to deal with property located entirely within the city of Little Falls and owned entirely by the city of Little Falls. The unanimous vote of the government of that city of Little Falls is to have this legislation repealed. I have with me today Tony Wenzel, Little Falls City Attorney. She'll give you a little more detailed information, and then we'll both stand for any questions that you may have. So,
all right, go ahead, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Tony Wetzel, City Attorney, Little Falls, Minnesota. I am here at the request of and on behalf of the Little Falls City Council. I am here today to ask for the repeal of what has been codified as Minnesota Statute Section 15.995. That particular law, as drafted, is applicable only to the city of Little Falls, and that law served to place restrictions on how the city of Little Falls could manage its property designated on the historical register. It, in effect, prevented the city from leasing, selling, contracting the property without a two-year waiting period and various appraisals from the historical society. And we're here today to ask for the repeal because that law was initially passed with the intention of trying to save and preserve two historical mansions in Little Falls known as Linden Hills. The unintended consequence, however, of that law was to completely and utterly handcuff the city of Little Falls from being able to engage in any type of business activity with respect to those two mansions. And also, it served to prevent the city from legally being able to operate its public library and its visitors and convention bureau, because it prohibits the city from being able to in any way lease a contract with respect to those properties. And since that was completely unfeasible for the city of Little Falls, the city subsequently commenced a lawsuit against the state of Minnesota in an attempt to have that law found unconstitutional. After a year of litigation still not coming to any type of a trial on the matter, an agreement was reached with the Attorney General's office that we would dismiss the lawsuit without prejudice and attempt to have this law repealed through the Minnesota legislature to avoid any future litigation. So that's all here today. It's with the hope of the Attorney General's office and their budget, as well as the City of Little Falls, that we can effectively repeal this statute. The statute applies only to the City of Little Falls and curbs the local government's ability to handle properties contained within the city limits. And we believe that that is not appropriate and that power should properly be vested with the City of Little Falls. The City Council has passed a unanimous resolution asking for this repeal, and as such, I am here today in that capacity.
All right. Questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Doty, you made the statement that this was supported by 100% of the City of Little Falls. Was there a referendum and... how did you get a city to vote 100% one?
100%, a unanimous vote of the city council.
The city council, okay.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
I don't know of any community that's ever voted 100% on anything, so I found that unusual.
Madam Chair and Representative Hilbert, certainly not in my district do we ever get 100%, no.
All right, further questions? Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Doty, is anyone opposed to repealing this? And I mean, what about the folks that originally wanted this to happen?
Representative Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative Hollis, I think pretty likely City Attorney Wetzel would be more qualified to speak to that. That the the issue is probably settled, in my understanding, but I'll let her give you specifics.
Ms. Wetzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue was put to the City Council. A public meeting was had on it. A resolution was passed. And therefore, if anybody had an objection to that, they certainly had an opportunity to present it. They had an opportunity to contact their council members. And after all of that, the council voted for this unanimously.
All right. Further questions? If not, I now have a quorum, so I will officially call this meeting to order. And I would move that House File 756 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with recommendation that it be re-referred to the Minnesota Heritage Finance Committee. Is
Madam
there any
Chair,
Representative House?
Would this have to, couldn't this go to the consent calendar? Or does the Chair of the Heritage Finance want to see it?
Apparently, the CA from the Heritage Committee agreed that that's where it needed to go. So, I'm happy to send you there. Sorry. So is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 756 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Minnesota Heritage Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right, next on the agenda is House File 849, Representative Moe. I will move that House File 8. Oh, actually, Representative House, you wanted to move this, correct?
Madam Chair, I would move House File 849.
Be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to Environment and Natural Resource Finance Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative.
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment that I believe the author would like moved, so I would move Amendment 0252.
All right. And is the author fine with that?
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Representative Moe, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative House moving the bill and the amendment. I'll give you a brief overview and then also just a couple statements about the amendment. What this bill does is allows for resorts who have a couple of issues to be able to actually continue with their property as a resort. If in fact there's a cabin that burns down, for example, and the ordinance have been changed since they built the cabin, and this in fact has happened many times. Coles Resort up in my neck of the woods, they had a cabin burned down and then it was non-conforming. It took them forever to rebuild that cabin. Allows them to rebuild structures and cabins if they are currently non-conforming, but when they were constructed, they were. It also allows if there's a zoning change, for example, you have to provide certain amenities that weren't in existence before. It allows cabin owners to meet those changes and minimally meet those changes without expanding forward towards the lake or laterally, they have to expand backwards. Also, it allows it removes a loophole that would allow that would increase the likelihood of resorts being turned over to planned unit developments in tax code. And we've been working with the other stakeholders, the Association of Townships, Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities. We currently they're no longer opposed to the bill, which is, you can, maybe if they're up there, you can, everybody can wave saying yes, the bill is fine now. And the amendment fixes some technical changes that were brought by some of the stakeholders in the previous committee. We worked with them. We're in agreement on those changes, and so that's what the amendment does. With that, I'd like to bring up Joel Carlson from the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and then maybe Mark. Mark out.
we have another chair here? Why don't you grab that one?
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
There you go. Go ahead, Stemmer. Joel, you want to start?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an association of small family-owned resort businesses in Minnesota, and I've had the pleasure to represent them since 1996. The bill before you today, this addresses three real small zoning issues for them that we feel a statewide consistent policy would be beneficial. I provided a memo to the committee that hopefully is in your packet that outlines those three major changes. But the two that are most important for us, Madam Chair and members, would be Section 2, Subdivision 4, and Section 2, Subdivision 5. We've had a number of instances where you have a resort that needs to maintain the structure, or it needs to rebuild. The resort unit needs to be rebuilt because of storm damage. And you'll have a situation where the Department of Health has a requirement of 60 square feet per individual for a bedroom, 120 square feet for two people. Your existing bedroom is 100 square feet. Right now, there's no ability in law to add those 20 square feet to be in compliance with the Department of Health requirements. And Section 2, Subdivision 4 would allow that to take place so that you can be in compliance with a code requirement. And that is particularly important for resorts as they try and maintain their operations and be viable. Other than that, Madam Chairman and members, happy to answer any questions. I have Mark Novotny from Hideaway Bay Resort, and it doesn't get any more Minnesotan than that. You know, we used to have about 3,600 resorts in Minnesota. We're down to about 900. We think measures like this and the assistance that we've been able to secure through the tax committee, can help stem the decline of small family-owned resorts. I see Representative Wincheski. I don't know how many times I can get in front of her in one day on resorts, but we appreciate the efforts of the legislature to recognize the vital role resorts play in our tourism and rural Minnesota economy, and appreciate your support.
Mr. Novotny? No. Is that how I say it?
Novotny, yes.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Mark Novotny. I'm the owner, my wife and I, of Hideaway Bay Resort near Hackensack, Minnesota. The Congress of Minnesota Resorts is in favor of this bill, and we've been pushing for it for quite some time because I'm actually in Cass County, and Cass County is quite resort friendly. But my neighboring counties and my neighboring resorts are having a difficult time trying to just improve their resorts. Some of them can't even replace a roof because their cabin may set between 10 and 15 feet away from the lake shore. And we feel that these cabins are vital to us surviving, and we need to have this enforced throughout the state rather than having separations between counties.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay. There's questions, Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moe. I spent a lot of time, probably 15, longer than that, 20 years fighting in local zoning ordinances, and a big part of that has been over shoreland and floodplain ordinances. And I understand that shoreland ordinance is a statewide ordinance. And so I'm really curious, how, especially the part about non-conforming uses. How can you just eclipse the shoreland ordinance on non-conforming uses?
Representative Mull.
I'll just respond quickly and you can details. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Shumper. A little background, and then I'll let Joel Carlson talk about it. As you know, resorts have been on these lakes, many of these lakes. Maybe you should come visit us a little. You know, I'd be glad to have you come visit, spend your money in Larry Howe's district or mine, Representative Solberg's.
But those resorts in particular have, for years, been much more kind to the environment and to the shoreline than the alternative development that's happened in many times when they close down. So recognizing that this is, in aggregate, far more beneficial to the environment than the alternative, we're trying to keep them, one, in business because we think that's a good idea, and two, recognizing that that resorts in general are far more beneficial to the environment for a variety of reasons, impact on the lake, water quality, all sorts of other things, than the alternative development that would happen, which would be a planned unit development. And
all right, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, would like the committee to know that as it relates to non-conforming uses, House File 849 is consistent already with already existing law that allows a non-conforming use to be rebuilt, and specifically Minnesota Statute 349.36, which deals with municipalities, and 462.375, which deals with counties. We have that ability right now to continue a non-conforming use. What we do not have is the ability to meet code requirements, which is that subdivision 4. And I handed out to the committee a piece from the Department of Natural Resources that have looked at shoreland issues. On the back page of that information from the Department of Natural Resources, would just want the committee to know that the things that are in Representative Moe's bill have been reviewed and supported by the Department of Natural Resources as being necessary for ongoing resort viability. These are things that even the DNR has not been opposed to in the shore impact zone.
Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, so your bill does not amend the current shorelands ordinance, statewide shorelands ordinance?
Representative Moe.
Or does it?
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, it does amend current state law. It adds a section allowing for these uses to be conforming. However, these changes, and maybe Mr. Carlson can concur, actually are consistent with the alternative shoreland ordinances that have been developed on by the statewide stakeholder process, which many of which you would like, knowing your politics, you would like to have implemented in your district. So this is actually better for the environment based on that stakeholder process. Those people who are advocating for stronger environmental restrictions worked at the table to establish these alternative shoreline ordinances.
All right, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I appreciate and Representative Moe, this is a good bill. We should have done this a couple years ago, but that's our fault. Mr. Carlson, where are all these people going? You said we've gone from, was it 3,200 resorts down to 900, 3,600 down to 900? I'm just curious. Where are they all going?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman, members, Representative Olson, the pressure for resorts to sell for residential development is severe. And I would say almost exclusively the resorts that have been sold have been that are converted are for residential use. So you'll take a 300-foot parcel of property that maybe has four or five cabins on it, and you'll end up with one or possibly two residences on that property. That is the overriding conversion is from resorts to individual residential use.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I'm familiar with that a little bit, but what's happening in the marketplace with regard to the people that were attending these resorts?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Olson and members, we think that with the declining number of resorts that the access to the resource is being restricted. And that's why we have been here to try and stem that decline so that we don't become the land of 10,000 lake accesses that we actually have resources that average people can utilize. And that's what resorts provide, is access to the resource. And that's a great question. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Olson. And let's just remember what the niche that resorts provide. They're the opportunity for working families who can't afford a cabin at the woods to have for a week, at a reasonable price, access to Minnesota's greatest resources. And we have a vested interest in making sure that both those families are able to access those resources, one, and two, those people come, and then they also go to our restaurants and they shop at our bait dealers and other things like that. It's important for our economy in many ways.
Thank you.
Representative Holberg.
I'll pass. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative House renews his motion that House File 849 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation it be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resource Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moe. All right, I'm going to move to the minutes quickly. Someone want to move the minutes? A Representative Lincheski moves the approval of the minutes for Wednesday, March 7th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Hearing none? Motion prevails. All right, members, before I call up the next bill, I just want you to know that on the cart are ham and turkey and buns for sandwiches, animal crackers, and drinks. I had 54 second graders here today, and this was their lunch, and so these are the leftovers. And so I would encourage you to eat them.
Is that an indication that we're bringing them on here?
Representative Solberg, it isn't, but the tax committee is, and so many of these members serve on the tax committee as well, including myself, and I wanted to make sure we were all fine. All right, so next on the agenda is House File 1105, Representative Lane. All right, I will move that House File 1105 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Thank you.
Representative Lane, go ahead.
Madam Chair. This is just a simple bill to increase the amount of money available to charter commissions in cities. There's about 107 of our 854 cities in Minnesota are charter cities that are formed and operated by a charter as opposed to by statute. And so about 15 citizens make application and are appointed by a district judge to the charter commission, and then they keep an eye on if there needs to be any changes. Well, it's actually kind of rare to have a change, but when a change is needed, you need to get out, and if your council doesn't agree with it, you need to get it out to the voters because it will go to an election. Well, the amount of money available to take the pros and cons in a neutral fashion out to the voters is only $1,500, and that doesn't get you very far. So if your city council doesn't want to give you any more money, they do have the option to do that, then you're pretty limited about getting the information out. So I looked and found out that this $1,500 goes back to 1961. And the CPI that brings that up to date would be $10,113. This bill just increases the amount to $5,000 because I figure that for $5,000 you could probably get a mailing out to maybe 10,000 folks, which I consider to be about average. And the costs are paid by the city, and the amount, this amount can then be gotten back by the city through a levy if they want to get the money back. So it's not any really weight on the city. It's really a small amount, but it allows the Charter Commission to really do its job, which is bring changes before the voters should they need to. The case in my city of Columbia Heights is that most of the five members of the city council come from one area of the city, and we were suggesting to the voters this, the possibility of wards, so that there would be people coming from different parts of the city. And, of course, city council didn't care for that, and then they didn't support our going forth. So we were able to get it out in a very limited way to a newspaper, but we were kind of hand-strung by this. And I'm just suggesting that we bring it somewhat up to date by just getting out of 1961 numbers and up to $5,000 that would be available to them in a year to do something.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and in your example, it says, maybe I'm not understanding how this works, but it says the city can pay up to this amount. So in your scenario, would the city still not give them more than $1,500?
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amount in statute is $1,500 that the city needs to give them if they need to, if they want to use it. The city can actually give more voluntarily, but if they don't, then the city charter, the charter commission is limited to that $1,500.
Oh. Representative Hobart.
Madam Chair, the legislation here says so paid by the city shall not exceed in any one year the sum of. I mean, current law, it doesn't look like it says it has to give them $1,500, but it can't exceed it.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, the first part of the sentence says that the amount of expenses that shall be paid shall not exceed, and I would read that to mean that the city has to pay up to that amount, and then after the semicolon, they have the option of paying additional charter commission expenses as necessary.
Representative Holbert?
I think it's confusing because it shall be paid by the city shall not exceed that much. So in other words,
that is confusing.
So, I mean, if I was a nasty city council member and I was reading this, I'd probably say, well, I don't think $1,000 of your charges are reasonable, and that's what we're going to support, and we're not going to support anymore.
Ms. Dyson, do you have a suggestion for making it more clear?
With a minute to read the sentence, I
quit. Okay. All right. While she works on that, we're going to ask if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill. Seeing none. Any other member questions? All right. Representative Lane, if we could just have you step to the side. I'm going to temporarily lay this bill over to allow staff to work on it, and we're just going to take up the next bill on the agenda.
Thank you.
All right. So I'll lay that bill over. All right. Next is House File 1193, Representative Saylor. Representative Saylor, I would move that House File 1193 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beltrami County has requested that I ask for opportunity to have the Office of Recorder made appointive in their county. I believe you have in your packets a copy of the a resolution from the Board of County Commissioners from Beltrami County. It was a unanimous decision. The current recorder was elected this year. Discussed at length during the campaign the need for having this be an appointed office rather than elective. They've had public hearings in Beltrami County regarding this issue. Nobody showed up. They had the hearing, but there was nothing to listen to. And so they would like to join with 23 other counties in Minnesota that allow the recorder to be appointed. And I would also just like to remind the committee that this is subject to reverse referendum if anyone should happen to have an objection to that in Beltrami County.
All right. Questions from members? Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Saylor, Beltrami County, do they have the ability to appoint their auditor right now?
Representative Saylor.
Madam Chair and Representative House, I don't believe that they do appoint their auditor, but I'm not sure if they do or not. I could find that out for you, but I'm not certain. They only wanted to deal with the recorder in this instance.
All right, Representative House.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, I'm not opposed to the bill. It's just that
right.
I've done this several times. I think Representative Solberg has done it. In fact, I thought I did it for Beltrami County, but maybe because they usually the counties want to do it with the auditor first, and then if they get greedy, they go for all the appointments. Actually, I have a very small, simple bill that if I had time, if you would be willing to take it on as an amendment, it would do this statewide to all roll officers. But we won't go there today, Madam.
All right. Thank you, Representative House. Further questions from members? Representative
Madam Chair, I actually can answer that question after I reviewed my notes here. Beltrami County does not have the auditor or treasurer appointed, but they have only specifically asked in this case for the recorder. Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1193 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Saylor. All right. Okay, we need just a few more minutes. Was Representative Dabney here? All right. He's not here now. Okay, Representative Marfor. Oh, here's Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney, we're ready for you. Are you ready?
Thank you
very much. All right. I will move that House File 1337 be recommended to be passed and be placed on the general register. Representative Dabney, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As when I used to both ride the bus more often and smoke, all I had to do was light a cigarette and the bus would come. So all I had to do was step out of the room and it was time for the bill. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to hear House File 1337. This bill allows, or seeks to allow, Minneapolis to consider doing what some 20 other municipalities in the metro area already do, including outstate cities, we'll try that, represented by a number of the members here. Currently, Minneapolis pays for street and lighting maintenance out of our general fund, pitting those needs against public safety and all other general fund responsibilities for the city. In the political tug of war between public safety and street lighting and maintenance usually loses out. That fact is exacerbated by fluctuations in the general fund, making long-term planning and preventive maintenance more difficult. With me today is Mr. John Wirtjes, Director of Traffic and Parking Services for the City of Minneapolis.
All right, Mr. Wirtjes. Go ahead, state your name for the record correctly.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. John Wirtjes, Director of Traffic and Parking at the City of Minneapolis. Thanks, Representative, for bringing this forward. Oddly enough, we uncovered this little obtuse, you might say, history on this law from 1973, and we really don't know much about the history of it, but as the representative indicated, we're just trying to give ourselves some options relative to how we fund and maintain our street lighting system and street maintenance. And so given that others have this and we don't know really why we got the 73 law in that regard, we're seeking some change on that. And I think with that, I'll just leave it for questions unless there are some.
All right, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney. Would you assure me that if this were to pass and then help the City of Minneapolis, that you will work with Representative Kahn to make sure we have the proper lighting?
Representative Dabney.
Representative Howes, my experience is that Representative Kahn is a force unto herself and can probably handle the lighting issue just fine. Thank you for asking.
All right. Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
I did not hear the initial motion. Where are you seeing this to go next?
To the general register.
I'm wondering if Chairman Chesky is going to want to see this in taxes.
Representative Chesky.
Well, thank you for that. You know, Representative Dabney, I don't think so because I'm trying to understand it. It's very strange law on the bottom of House Research at the footnote. The footnote is really the key there. And I don't know who came up with that special law in 1973, but
it appears that you were supposed to calculate assessments levied into future years for aggregate receipts for your levy limits, but I think the reason it wouldn't need to go to taxes is levy limits aren't in place right now, so it seems to me that you can move forward, but I'm not sure if you can give us a little history on this 1973 special law.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, no, we can't. we might just say, you know, it was the 70s. and leave it at that. But that's, I think, the best we've been able to figure out about the history of this special statute.
All right, Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair and Representative Lincheski, I could just about imagine it was one particular legislator who had a little bone to pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I will renew my motion then that House File 1337 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register with the understanding that if Representative Lincheski decides she needs to see it, that you'll bring it back.
I think that probably goes unstated anyways, but thank you.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none. Motion prevails.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. All right. Representative Lane, we're ready. I will move House File 1105 and be taken from the table. We'll take it from the table. Ms. Dyson, if you could help us.
Madam Chair and members, to hopefully clarify the language of the current law, what I would recommend is on page 1, line 11, strike everything after the period, strike line 12, and then on line 13, strike all of line 13 and delete the new language, and then replacing that, insert a city of the first class must pay up to $10,000 in any one year for reasonable and necessary expenses of the Charter Commission, period. Another city, any other city, must pay up to $5,000 in any one year for reasonable and necessary expenses of the Charter Commission, a city, and then it would pick up on line 14 with Council may authorize such additional charter expenses as it deems necessary.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that give the local city council the prerogative to determine whether or not it's really a reasonable expense that the Charter Commission wants to expend? When it says must pay, it seems to me that it takes away any local city council discretion as to whether the request is reasonable or not.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lane.
One thing she added was must pay up to, and they're asking about what part is reasonable. In the situation where you would have, if the Charter Commission, by either voters coming to them and asking for a change or determines on their own that there should be a change, they take it to the City Council, and if the City Council agrees unanimously, then it's done. It doesn't have to go to the voters. But if there's not a unanimous vote by the council, then it automatically goes, by virtue of the Charter Commission wanting to continue it, to the voters. And all we're asking is that the ability to send out to the voters the neutral information, it fits current costs. So it isn't really up to the council at that point to determine what that would be. It's up to the Charter Commission to do that job. It's their job.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lane, as a member of my local Charter Commission, longtime mayor, I'm well aware of that. And that was not my question. My question was, the way this language was redrafted, does it basically force the local city council to accept that they have to pay up to that amount? You know, they have no discretion as to whether or not the expense is reasonable or not.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I'm not sure how to answer your question except to say that I believe current law is already in that position. The rewriting was an attempt to make it an active voice sentence so that it clarifies, but I believe that it already says that the city shall
pay the reasonable and necessary charter commission expenses up to $10,000. So if it hasn't been an issue till now, then I don't know that it would be. It would not be any different. The intent was not to change what is current by the way I worded it. So if you believe it does, then maybe that's a different problem. But I don't, that wasn't the intent of what I wrote.
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then that would basically say that the difference between shall and must is there is no difference.
Ms.
Dyson? The way you're reading the law.
Madam Chair, that is how I'm reading it. And if there is, you know, better counsel from those who are more familiar with the charter commissions and how they've actually functioned, I, you know, defer to their better counsel on that. But that's how I read this, is that it is currently mandatory.
All right. Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I wasn't here. I don't know if this came up earlier, but what is the problem with the bill as it was originally drafted? It seemed to be very clear to me what that was trying to accomplish, so I'm wondering why we're redrafting.
Ms. Dyson, do you want to? It was actually Representative Holberg, so yes. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, if you read the sentence starting on line 11 with the word "the," it just seemed like the wording of it must up to or must be paid so by the city and then shall not exceed. I mean, it just seemed confusing. The current law seemed confusing.
Hmm.
But as I listened to the discussion and where we're going with this, I thought there was discretion up to the $1,500, and now Ms. Dyson is saying no, that up to $1,500 had to be paid out, and raising that to $5,000 having to be paid out by the city for any charter commission makes me nervous, especially when current law allows for additional expenses to be paid at the discretion of the city council.
All right, well, Representative Lane, it is your bill, and so I will let you decide if you just want to amend this $5,000 and leave the sentence current law as it is. We can send you on your way, or if you would like to use Ms. Dyson's cleanup language.
I would preface it by saying that $1,500 in 1961 is the equivalent of over $10,000 today. So saying it, changing it to $5,000 is not a worrisome thing, in my opinion, because it rarely happens. But at least it gives it enough, the commission enough to work with. As far as the wording, I think it cleans it up if you're willing to go with the change. If anybody has any concerns about that, I'm willing to stay with the wording we have.
Comments from members? Representative Holberg?
Well, Madam Chair, I think I apologize for starting this mess, but I mean, I would support the change in wording because I think it is more clear. I'm just not going to support the bill to raise the limit to $5,000 because current law allows the council to pay more if they want.
Absolutely. All right.
All right,
Representative Lane.
I will support the changed wording.
All right. All right. I would move the amendment. Does staff have the amendment? Do members have the amendment, the language, so it's clear? All right. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. I would renew my motion that House File 1105 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
All right. Is Representative Marquardt back in the room? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Marquardt, this needs to be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. So if you'd like to make that motion.
I will make that motion that House File 1327 be referred to the Environmental Policy Committee. Is that okay?
Yes.
I'd make that motion.
All right. Representative Marquardt moves that House File 1327 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Marquardt, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. And this has actually been a topic I've been working on for actually a number of years. And for some of you, this summer I sent out a letter very identical to the letter that you have right now in your packets, and it was addressed to Chairman Olson and members. And so this letter hasn't changed much, but since that time, this report came out, which was the Office of the Legislative Auditor's Watershed Management Report. And so many of the things that were listed in this report paralleled a lot of the things I mentioned in that letter. Now, while this report talks about lake improvement districts, on page 17 it says we did not evaluate lake improvement districts. My bill looks just at lake improvement districts. And just for members, lake improvement districts were established in 1978 to give property owners around lakes some more say in water management. Now, a lot of times these lake improvement districts get confused with property owners associations. And property owners associations are usually voluntary, where you pay dues. And what these associations will do around a lake can be dealing with water clarity, dealing with weeds. They might sponsor the July 4th fireworks, parades, a number of things. A lake improvement district is a different creature in that it involves property owners around a lake, usually 1,000 feet along the shoreline, kind of a bandwidth. But the major difference from an association is that it can levy for taxes. That levy has to be approved by the county board, but they have the authority to levy, and also they hold elections. And if you are a property owner, you don't have to be a permanent resident along the lake, but if you are a property owner, you can be on this board. So I have to tell you as a disclaimer that I am a member of a lake improvement district, the Pelican Group of Lakes Improvement District. I'm also going to say I'm not a fan of lake improvement districts, so you'll know where I'm coming from. But what this watershed management recommendation said, and it was on in the executive summary, is that the legislature should require Bowser, now this is different, but same principle, to provide greater oversight. Specifically, the legislature should require Bowser to, one, establish performance and operational standards for local water management entities, collect performance, financial, and activity data from each entity, monitor the performance and activities of these entities, and release public assessments of their performance. House File 1327, really, that's what this does. If you look at the two parts, the one is it's asking the Lake Improvement District, requiring them to provide all sorts of financial data that would be sent to the Department of Natural Resources that basically kind of supervises these things. And then the second part of it would be, I almost take the word for word, where the Department of Natural Resources must regularly assess whether each district is meeting the purposes of this section of law. Why do I have this concern? Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, let me find my notes here. In that letter that I sent out, there's two major sections in the law. One deals with the purposes of what lake improvement districts are supposed to do, and then there's another section that lists 14 powers that the board of directors can do. Almost everything in the purposes deal with water quantity and quality, and 13 of the 14 powers deal with water quantity or quality. So to me, the legislative intent of lake improvement districts was to deal with water quantity and quality. And yet, what I have done, and hopefully members, did you receive this budget worksheet here? Did you? This was, actually the second time I had done this, and this was, there's a number of lake improvement districts, but there are 17 active ones that I could find. And this information was derived from me calling the counties or calling these lake improvement districts and getting this information. And it's based on the 2006 budgets. That was the latest information. And what I found out when I went through these, that 5 of the 16 reporting lake improvement districts are spending less than 50% of their proposed 06 budgets directly on water issues. In fact, one is spending 34% of their budget, which is about $42,000, on mosquito control. And another is spending 54% of its budget on street lighting around the lake. Now, I'm not necessarily opposed to any one of those. I just don't know if that meets the intent of what a lake improvement district was supposed to do. Also, 5 of the 16 reporting LIDs are spending over 20% of their budgets on administration, and almost one half have cash reserves that are larger than their actual yearly expenditures. Now, I know that sounds like micromanaging, but the fact of the matter is, just like I think what happened in this report, is it shows that there maybe is a lack of supervision. Now, county boards have to approve of these lake improvement districts, so there is kind of that oversight. But my bill would require not only this information on all the finances that you see right here would have to be filed with the Department of Natural Resources, so there would be a clearinghouse if someone wanted to see this data, but also the DNR would be required to look at what these lake improvement districts are doing and say, is that meeting the intent of the law? So with that, members, I guess I'll stand for questions. It's really following what's on that report, but applying that to lake improvement districts.
All right, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, you referred to the legislative auditor's report, and I know that there are bills in process. In fact, I'm working on one that would implement a number of the recommendations in that report. And I guess my question would be, why don't we have Bowser provide the oversight here instead of the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner? Because I think what's going to happen legislatively is we're going to be looking at proposals to strengthen Bowser's hand in providing oversight on water management, and why would we want to bifurcate this oversight, and maybe Bowser would be more appropriate to be the providing the oversight here.
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, that's a great point. I'd certainly be very agreeable to that. The reason I put the Department of Natural Resources, because they were given the authority by the legislature to devise the rule making and to basically run these, or get them going, these lake improvement districts. But if we could create consistency, and I know, Representative Lanning, that's what you're looking to do, is kind of bring all these organizations together. If, in fact, it would do the intent of what I'm looking at, I would be totally in support of that. So, and it wouldn't have to go through DNR.
Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you. I would certainly suggest that we have that kind of consistency. And I don't know, maybe this can get fixed then in environmental finance or wherever else it goes next. But and I know I've discussed this same concept with a number of folks on that committee, and so I think they would be interested in that kind of change as well.
All right. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I appreciate your diligence on this issue. I worked on LIDS some years ago, and what we did then was something to try to create more LIDS, and I know that isn't what you're really looking for here, but accountability, you're actually applying the same strategy we did in the respect that we're trying to make them more accountable and easier to establish and yet be more accountable so that people wouldn't be afraid to do it. So I think you have a noble effort here. I just have two questions. On line 14, as I read that, the $1,000 figure really represents criteria for anything not referenced in that new language. Because there's some items in the new language that could be less than $1,000. So if I read this correctly, my understanding is that you're talking about listing any other expenditures that are $1,000 or more. Is that correct?
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, that's correct. And there was no specific science to setting that threshold, but just everything else that wouldn't be included in any of those other areas, if they were spending $1,000, they'd have to list it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was what the other thing I was wondering is where that came from, if it shouldn't be $500 or something like that. But I'll leave that for the committee. My other question is on line 22. What do you mean by regularly assess? That yearly, biannually?
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I left this a little bit open-ended because I wanted to work with something either Bowser or Department of Natural Resources would feel comfortable with. It could be an annual basis. If for some reason they absolutely couldn't do that, at least every 2 years, I guess I'd be willing to work on that. My intent would be on an annual basis.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it should be clear, but it probably should be dealt with the Environment Committee because of those who are going to do it. Probably is more under that jurisdiction of that committee. But if you just make a note of that, and I'll leave that $1,000 figure for further discussion as well. But I appreciate the bill and I appreciate your diligence on the issue.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none. Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 1327 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, motion prevails.
Thank you,
Madam Representative
Chair,
Marquardt.
Members.
All right. Oh, do you want to move over here? All right, Adam.
Sir. Proceed, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 1160 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred. No, just the Committee on Finance. Great. Not to go anywhere else. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1160 is the issue that Representative Biskins has been very active in as well, and I'm sorry to say that he was on the agenda but has had a family emergency, and so we have removed his item from the agenda.
Representative Hillstrom, did you want to also move your amendment?
I will, just a moment, sorry. So I just wanted members to be clear that that's the reason Representative Biskins' bill will not be heard today. But I do have the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that I would like it. And I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom has moved the A1, has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill permits public entities to establish revocable or irrevocable trusts to pay post-employment benefits, and I will then now turn it over the testifier. So if you would go ahead and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I am legal counsel of the School Board Association. I've basically been elected by the other groups of political subdivisions to come up and make this presentation on behalf of the school boards, the cities, and the counties. As Representative Hillstrom said, this bill allows public entities to create and maintain trusts and to invest the funds that are in those trusts at a higher rate than you could if you were just using short-term investments. And it puts protections in place for those funds that are invested. Now, these trusts are used to pay retiree health insurance, primarily. This bill has been worked on and is supported by all the county groups, the cities, the school districts, the representatives of the banks, the representatives of the insurance companies and the insurance agencies. It has been reviewed by the state auditor. The changes that have been requested by the state auditor, and you will recall the prior state auditor was very actively involved in this. The current state auditor is involved in this. Any changes that they requested that provide protections are incorporated into this bill. It incorporates the changes that have been suggested by the legislative auditor in the January 07 report on this issue. That report recommended that the legislature should amend Minnesota statutes to allow local governments to establish trusts for funding other post-employment benefits, which is retiree health insurance. This bill does not require anybody to establish a trust. It doesn't require you to put money in it, but if you're going to comply with or it allows you to do so, it doesn't require you, and it doesn't provide a funding source that will pay for this. That's a separate issue. But if you choose to put the money aside, this will allow you to do so. I don't know if the legislative auditor's report was presented here, but there are a number of reasons why you would put money into one of these trusts. First, it would assume that or would assure that the money would be there when it was needed. It would recognize retiree benefits as a form of compensation, and it would allow them to be these benefits to be paid for today rather than tomorrow. The value of doing it is basically twofold. The money is held in trust to pre-fund these benefits. And also, you are allowed to invest the money that's in the trust at a higher rate than you could if it were just in a general city or school district account. And we'll get to that when we go through it. But when you are allowed to invest at that higher rate, that reduces your liabilities because those interest earnings go to reduce the liabilities. And that's a good thing. That's why when the Duluth bill was here, it was costing them X number of dollars a day until they got that bill passed, because that would save them that kind of money. Let me briefly just go through the bill and explain quickly how this works and where these changes came from. The first subdivision basically says that you can establish these trusts. You may establish them. You're not required to, but you may. They can only be used to pay post-employment benefits, and they can either be revocable or irrevocable, and we'll get to that issue in a minute. It provides that if you establish a trust, you have three options for who your trust administrator will be. The first option is you can have PERA, the Public Employees Retirement Association, be the trust administrator. They would establish an account, and it would go through there. You can have a bank that has trust powers, can be the trust administrator, or you can have an insurance company or agency that's qualified to do business in Minnesota, which has at least 5 years' experience in investment products and services for group retirement benefits, and which has a specialized department dedicated to services for retirement investment products. Any one of those three can serve as a trust administrator for one of these OPEB trusts. Now, if you put the money in a trust and you decide that you put it in the wrong one, or you could have gotten more money if you put it in a different one and you want to change, the language on 2.3 to 2.5 allows you to change trust administrators. Subdivision 4 allows you to establish a trust account. It allows the trust administrator to charge reasonable fees for reasonable administrative costs of these trusts. The amount of any fees that are charged by PERA can stay with PERA. They get to keep that money. That's why the bill says appropriating money in the title. There is no actual appropriation of money. It just allows them to keep the fees. The language that's on 2.14 to 2.18 was language that came directly from the state auditor, and this provides that the trust administrator has to report to the political subdivision or other public entity on the investment returns of the invested trust assets and on all investment fees or costs incurred by the trust. And the annual rates of return, and along with those fees, have to be included or disclosed in the public entity's annual financial audit in the manner prescribed by the state auditor. This will provide transparency and comparability between these different options. And everybody will know what those fees and that are, and that's the state auditor believed that was a very important protection. Subdivision 5 provides that if you go through the PERA, the money will be invested by the State Board of Investment under Section 11A14. If it's invested by either a bank or the insurance company option, it will be invested by a registered investment advisor, a bank investment trust department, or an insurance company or agency retirement investment department. These are professionals in this type of investment. The items that they can invest in are the same as are allowed for the covered pension plans that are out there. All the various pension plans that are not statewide plans, this can be invested in those same types of investments. And the political subdivision can provide investment direction to a trust administrator in compliance with the document. For instance, even if you go through PERA and the State Board of Investment is doing the investing, they have three asset allocation modules that you can choose from if you want to. Subdivision 6 says you can't put in more money in here than is necessary to cover this. You can't use this to just stash money aside. It can only be up to the amount of the actuarially determined liabilities. Now, Subdivision 7 deals with the two types of accounts that are allowed in this bill. The first is a revocable account. If you put the money in a revocable account, that will not in and of itself comply with GASB 45 and allow a set off of any liabilities. But we have many political subdivisions where they believe that there may be changes that come down the road in the future, and they don't want that money tied up in such a way that they could never get it out if they no longer had any liability. So this allows them to put it into a revocable trust. It can only be used to pay post-employment benefits unless you meet one of these four exceptions. Like there's a change in state or federal law that affects their liabilities for post-employment benefits. Or there's a change in the demographic composition of the political subdivision of the people that are eligible. For instance, if you had 10 people in your school district that were eligible for these, and five of them die one year, now you've got you may have twice as much in there as you need. In the revocable one, you could take out the excess. In the irrevocable one, you cannot. If there's a change in the provisions or terms of those benefits, or if there's other factors that mean that you have more than 100% of the money that you need in there, you can take that out of a revocable trust document. For an irrevocable trust document, that money is set aside. It's an offset to any liability that you may have, and that can only be used to pay post-employment benefits owed to former officers and employees until all those benefits are paid and there is no more risk. A political subdivision that creates the trust must ensure that any withdrawals that are made comply with the requirements of this section. It's the political subdivision that has the liability for doing that. So if the money flows through PERA, PERA picks up no liability if they're told to pay out the money. Whoop. And they do so. That will show up, however, in that political subdivision's audits if they did it wrong. Subdivision 8 basically is language that was requested by the legislative auditor, and it makes it clear that the money is held in trust for the exclusive benefit of those retirees, and it's not subject to claims by creditors of the state, by creditors of the participating political subdivision or public entity, by the current or former officers and employees of the political subdivision, or by the creditors of the trust administrator. Section 2 validates some trusts that were created prior to June 6, 2006. On June 6, 2006, the Attorney General came down with an opinion that said the political subdivisions did not have the authority to establish irrevocable trusts that would comply with GASB 45. And whether that opinion was correct or not, at least for school districts, we're bound by that. All those ones that were set up were school district ones. This validates those, allows them to continue in full force and effect, and allows them to continue to accept new funds. They can be invested at the higher rate, and then they have, if there's anything they need to do to bring that trust that was out there into compliance with this law, they have until January 1, 2008 to do that. This bill would be effective the day following final enactment, because it's necessary that this be in place. Large cities are under this, and counties are under this requirement now. Large school districts will be under this requirement by July 1. This doesn't replace the Duluth bill. That had some other provisions in it that are not in this for other types of investments. As I said, this is supported by all the major political subdivision organizations, and we know of no organized opposition to this measure.
Representative Hausman, I believe you had a question for the testifier.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just curious whether this is generally the approach of Duluth. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, this is a little broader approach than Duluth. Duluth could only go through PERA, and this one allows PERA or a bank with trust powers or an insurance company that has those retirement sections.
I believe Representative Olson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom or Tom, Representative Bilskin's bills here, I'm not sure what your plans are, if you're going to move yours forward today, but just as a matter of comparison, I'd be interested in knowing what the differences are in the two bills.
Certainly.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. Representative Biskins has been working on this issue for a long time, and he put in his language prior to all of the stakeholders getting together and coming up with final language. And so his intent was to bring his bill up today. We were going to lay that over, and because this is the compromise language of all the stakeholders, okay, now that the auditor has weighed in and the legislative auditor, it was the intent to, and he was going to support my bill moving forward.
But
Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, and not meaning to detract from the testimony of your bill, but I'm just curious what the differences are, because it helps define the issues that are behind the bill.
Representative Hillstrom?
And now resolved, as I understand it. I'm just curious what they are.
Mr. Chair, this bill allows either irrevocable or revocable trusts. Representative Diskin's bill doesn't get to that. This bill has the protections that I listed that the state auditor has requested. It allows, Representative Biskin's bill is not as clear on who can be the trust administrator as this one is. But the bills are not in opposition necessarily to each other. It's just that there were more people that had the opportunity to work on this, and we took input from anybody that wanted to give input to make sure that all the protections were there, because this is really a very important bill to all the political subdivisions.
Thank you. I have a lot to learn in this area, and I appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hilstrom, would you like to renew your motion?
I think you should ask if there's anyone in the audience
who
wishes
sorry,
to testify
right.
for or against the bill.
Were there any others here who would like to testify on this bill?
All right.
I guess there wasn't.
All right.
Would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 1160 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
Motion failed. Thank you. Motion Representative passed. Lincheski is next, and you can continue to chair.
Oh.
Oh, I was going to make myself...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1005.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, House File 1005 allows local units of government to bond for these post-employment benefits. Some of you may know that we already authorized municipalities to do this for pensions, and this would extend this to post-employment benefits. And that's it.
Okay. I think I was supposed to say that this is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes?
Yes, that's correct.
Sorry. Did you have a witness?
I do. Mr. Carlson is with me from the county.
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Metro Minnesota Intercounty Association. We do appear here in support of this legislation. I think, as the committee knows, possibly ad nauseum at this point, there's a new accounting standard, GASB 45, which will require us to account for these post-employment benefits on a pay as the benefit accrues or is earned rather than as the benefit is paid. With that implementation of that new accounting standard, there may be a very large increase in the liabilities that some local government units will have to carry on their books. And consequently, to show to their bondholders or future potential bondholders that they're responsibly dealing with this issue, they will want to fund or pay down these liabilities as quickly as possible. By allowing the issuance of bonds for these, it will allow a way for the local affected local government units to ease into paying off that debt over the term of those bonds than rather all of a sudden having a big bump in their property tax levy. So this is just providing flexibility as exists currently for paying off unfunded accrued liabilities for pensions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Dominguez, did you have a question?
No.
Any questions? Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing and hearing none, I will... would you like to renew your motion?
I would. I would renew my motion, if I could speak today, Mr. Chair. House File 1005 to be referred to tax.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Where'd he go? He was here. Representative Beard, are you here?
He just stepped out for me.
I think he just stepped out for me.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see.
There he is. He's been ready. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 531, move its passage, and refer to General Register. Or where do you want it to go? General Register?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, this House File 531 is very similar to a bill we heard and passed last year on behalf of the Washington County Library System. We're doing this, requesting the same thing. This year, I see this bill as an efficiency in government, good government bill. Under general law, Minnesota statutes, the county board can appoint a library board, which Scott County has done many years ago. But once appointed, the library board has to stay in total control of all the operations. Because of the growth of Scott County and the sophistication of the library system that it has and the amounts of money involved, we're at that point in our existence where it makes sense to come back to the legislature and ask for a special statute that enables the county board to actually take over control of the financial end of the library operations. The library board will continue to exist, continue to make policy decisions on what goes in the library and what internet provider we use and so on and so forth, rent out the rooms and do the scheduling with the library. But the county board, because it meets every week instead of once a month or every couple months, can actually make week-to-week decisions regarding the budgeting, the billing, and so on and so forth. I do have a couple of witnesses to testify on behalf of the bill from Scott County, Mr. Chair, if I may introduce them.
You certainly may. Go ahead.
First, I'd like to introduce the chair of the Scott County Board, Mr. Commissioner John Ulrich.
Welcome, Mr. Ulrich. Would you like to testify? Please,
okay.
Please state your name.
Sorry. I'm John Ulrich, chair of the Scott County Board. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak to this issue. This change is...
Maybe you could pull your microphone a little closer there.
All right. This change was implemented in 2005 by Washington County, and their efforts were modeled after the structure of Hennepin County and St. Paul and the city of Duluth. We will be retaining the library board, and they will continue to review materials and purchase materials and provide advice and direction to the county board. But by having the county board oversee the library, we'll have greater accountability and greater integration into the life of the county and a greater visibility to the library. When the library board was considering this, they looked closely at the experience of Washington County, a very positive experience that Washington County had by making this move. And Pat Conley from Washington County Library was here. I don't know if she was able to stay, but she cited some positive outcomes that were occurred for the change. It was a more efficient management structure, and as the county board meets more regularly, they could respond more quickly to needs. And the library was more integrated into the culture of the county and as well as the library employees. And then finally, there's an accountability that comes from people, elect those that are overseeing the library. And so for those reasons, we ask your support of this legislation. And Kate Olson here is now also to speak to this. She's a member of the library board.
Ms. Olson, could you state your name?
Yes, thank you. My name is Kate Olson, and I'm chairman of the Scott County Library Board, and I'm just here to say that on behalf of the Scott County Library Board, we endorse this legislation as it will be the right move for Scott County at this time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm grateful for the folks who actually run the library system to come down and speak to you on behalf of this bill. Encourage your support. We'll be happy to stand for questions if there are any.
Fine. Are there any questions of these witnesses from any of the committee members? Is there any other public testimony in regards to Representative Beard's bill? Doesn't appear to be. Representative Beard, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to renew my motion that House Bill 531 pass and be referred to the General Register.
Fine. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Thank you, members.
Yes. Thank you. And the chair informs me that we are adjourned.